This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com. And this was our fourth Kate Chung episode with Kate Wolf and my co-host Margie Schnibbe. Ran live on Kate Chung Sunday evening, the 7th of September. And I don't really have any sense that there are too many listeners at 10 p.m. on a Sunday night listening to the show. I'm not really sure what the benefit of the Kate Chung format is. Maybe it will be different if I get a different shift. So I'm open to that. But for now, I'm wondering if I should phase out the Sunday once a month 10 p.m. slot. Just an FYI, great conversation with Kate Wolf about her various writing projects and Workspace, which was a reading series she did, and so on. You will hear all about it. Before we get to that conversation, let me just remind you that you can support the show. The show needs your support. One of a few ways you can donate to the show. The show is in the red, so your financial contribution, however small, is appreciated. You can do that via theconversationpod.com. You can also become a social media fan on Twitter or Facebook. You can write a nice review of the show on iTunes, which is linked via the website. Brings more people to the show, which is always great. So that's really about it for now. Let us get into that conversation with Kate Wolf. Thank you for being here. I will talk to you later. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw, and once again, I'm joined by Made in L.A. fundraiser, DP. Any other titles that I'm leaving out?
It's Kate Chung, fundraising coordinator.
Kate Chung, fundraising coordinator.
And I'm a part of the Kate Chung TV team.
Right.
Made in L.A., and a lot of us have been doing all different positions, video, tech,
director,
cameras,
DP.
But it's been a really great experience.
And you are Margie Schnibbe.
Oh, yeah, Margie Schnibbe.
By the way. And our guest today is Kate Wolf.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. Great to be here.
Yeah. A writer and, I guess, editor at large at Los Angeles Review of Books.
Yes, former art editor, but now editor at large.
Okay. Are you writing any art stuff?
For them, I don't know. I coordinate this portfolio that we have in our print magazine, which is an artist portfolio. So we've done, the first one was Barbara T. Smith, and we did James Welling. Last issue we did Ruby Neary. And this one, I'm not quite sure who we're going to do. So sometimes I write the intros for that. But I don't know. I'd like to keep on writing for them because they're a really great resource, you know, for LA-based writers and national writers. And
yeah,
just because then they publish a lot. So there's a lot of turnover. You can, and, you know, publishing lengthy pieces and kind of, if you have something, you can bring it there. So, yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting is that you write some about art and you write about culture, I guess, right?
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
You're not, I think we should start by clarifying that you're not an art critic. You're not even I mean, would you call yourself an arts writer?
No,
or?
You know, I really think of it that I guess that's become my beat more. I mean, that's because most of my friends are in the arts and I love art and I feel like I'm surrounded by it all the time. And I guess that's kind of what I gravitate towards in terms of subject matter. Especially for nonfiction and journalism. But I feel like it's just one subject and that I identify more as a writer who could kind of write about anything or that's the real, you know, it's that the same kind of problems would apply every time, no matter the subject I was writing about. So I don't feel like that's my one thing.
Yeah.
But certainly I've spent a lot of time over the last 10 years, you know, kind of writing about either artists or art events or, you know, little histories of different kind of scenes in LA a little bit here and there. So
what kind of scenes?
Well, I wrote this long piece about the Temple of Man for East of Borneo, which is this online magazine from CalArts based
right.
in Cal. And so that was a kind of this interesting, you know, quasi, it still exists today. You know, like George Herms is in the Temple of Man, and there are
why don't you give? Can you give us a brief synopsis? Of the
Well, it was this guy Bob Alexander who was friends with Wallace Berman, and he started this kind of organization of people. He would deem people ministers of the Temple of Man. They would have, you know, they would give marriage ceremonies. His house, which was in Venice, was kind of a meeting place. And they had yoga classes and rummage fairs and screenings and readings at Beyond Baroque. And he was kind of like a bit of a frustrated artist, I think. But this was kind of, it's hard to say if it was a, you know, it was kind of civic do-gooding or also part of a larger persona performance that he developed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it went, you know, he had these hot tub weddings at his property.
Well, I'm glad you said that because okay. just a quick interjection, because when you started talking about the House of Man,
Temple of Man, yeah,
you were reminding me of this thing called hot tub mystery religion, which was a thing which is, as it turns out, spoiler alert, not quite as glamorous as I, you know, the title makes it sound.
I don't know how glamorous it took place
in Dallas, and the guy who started it actually like came up with this whole reading list, you know, for the quote unquote religion and what have you. And, you know, so it was really appealing to me that, you know, the idea of merging hot tubs and religion, but
well, it's a baptism, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. Well, among other things, I mean, it's hedonism, you know, it's all of these things, but yeah.
I mean, Leonard, you know, Leonard Cohen, who had the Wet magazine. So kind of a whole magazine in LA that was based around bathing and
tell us more.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that much more, but it would, he, you know, it was kind of this whole, it was like a subculture, the subculture of water and
right.
being in the bathroom and being naked and kind of he's really into Japanese kind of aesthetics and simplicity mm-hmm. and, you know, this, I think it's a territory other people have noticed, but
right,
yeah.
Right. But we shouldn't get carried away because the sort of pseudo cult landscape isn't your beat per se, right?
Well, I do think I am interested. I mean, it definitely compels me. So it's not my only thing, but yes, I'm attracted to mm-hmm. people who, you know, actually I was going to say, speaking of not being a real art writer, I tried to write this piece on the Mountain School, like 3 or 4 years ago, and I brought it to Los Angeles Magazine, which is kind of a pretty mainstream magazine, you know, and it was like, it ended up being very embarrassing for me because I was approaching it more like, okay, I think this is really cool, I'd like to write about it, but they tried to make it like sensationalistic, like, oh, this school that meets in a bar, you know, that was like the only thing they really, that's the whole reason they told me that they wanted to publish it, because it was like this novelty, like a school that meets in a bar.
Yeah.
But I was more drawn to it because it seemed like, oh, this community, it has a utopian ideal. It's free. It's like people come from all over the world to go to this strange school that has no credentials. So I think that seemed kind of like a misfit thing that I was drawn to. Or Temple of Man, same thing. These kind of like, not necessarily cultish, but these self-made communities have always fascinated me.
Well, let's not leave the Mountain School just yet.
Okay.
Since you did write this piece that ultimately did not end up
kind
running.
Of a disaster, I thought.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, it was mainly a disaster between you and the magazine.
I just caved into a lot of things. I was younger and I, you know, there are things that really made me uncomfortable that they changed, but then, you know, that's always.
So they did print it?
Yeah, they did.
And how was it? Was it greatly shortened as well?
No,
or
it wasn't
just
that much. They gave me a word count that I wrote towards. I just thought it was, you know, they interjected a lot of things I would never have. You know, when someone, it's like one thing when people change your language, but when they kind of give you new ideas that aren't yours without discussing it with you.
Yeah.
I don't really appreciate that as a writer, I guess, because it seems like it's not earned. I didn't think of it. So why would we publish that? But I understand you have to have make the piece punchy, and maybe sometimes I'm just a little too like naturalistic, and I'm not that judgmental of people, so that comes off like I'm not, you know.
So does that mean that the editor changed your writing, but you didn't have sort of final approval?
See, that's the whole thing.
I'm just trying to
understand. Yeah, she does. So basically, the process is, you know, you get one edit, then you change, then there are more edits, then it keeps on going and going, and by the end, you're just usually so worn down. You say, oh, whatever, fine, I'll just publish it, sure. Or, you know, you've already, like, taken the money, and you're like, am I going to? And it was over a year. It was over here. I mean, it's not a horrible piece. It's not like I'm like, but I just, it was just embarrassing. And
well, it's like, I know from directing movies, when you work with a production company, I mean, you have a producer and there's certain things that they want. And even though that's really not everything that you want in there, you have to give in to certain things.
Oh yeah.
And it's a job and you're getting paid, and it's about, you know, you take this out and you can keep this. You have to just back and forth. So you have to give in a little bit, otherwise your movie doesn't get made.
Right. And I think that's the same thing. It's often the same process with writing and then being edited. It's, you know, you have to choose your battles, and, you know, there's some things that obviously you have to have some kind of limit to what you'll let someone do to your work, but it's also like, oh, well, you know, if you just, exactly, you have to give in at some point, because it's never going to be just that you write something and then it just is published.
But it also what's interesting is that then exposes your work or the Mountain School or whatever the scene is to a much wider audience.
Exactly.
Because Los Angeles Magazine is a larger magazine.
And that's what, I think it's, I mean, I guess that's also maybe, you know, where that, yeah, I feel like I'm interested in not having, being kind of fluid between smaller crowds, larger crowds, so I can appreciate that. But there are a lot of things in terms of, you know, in the arts or in art writing or in art magazines, art publications, that people just, you would take for granted that people would understand or know, or the reference point, or kind of like a history of performance or artists that people would just know of. And so you wouldn't even have to point things out. It would just be implicit. But if you are writing for a bigger audience, having to explain things and things that maybe I feel embarrassed doing, or make really declarative sentences that I don't want to, you know, I don't want to come out and say exactly what someone's doing. I'd like to like leave it more ambiguous because I don't really know what they're doing. So I could just interpret a little bit, but that's the push and pull, I guess. I mean, you know, it was definitely a learning experience. And
I'm interested in that dividing line between a more mainstream audience, you know, and sort of the niche art audience.
Right.
I mean, you know, vis-a-vis this podcast, among other things, how much do you have to explain, you know, about things? And I guess all that to say, what was the response to the article? Did you have any kind of sense of what the, you know, were people who otherwise wouldn't have known about the Mountain Bar interested in the Mountain Bar?
Well, I mean, not that I know of per se. I mean, it's not like I don't think I got like any letters to the editor or anything,
right.
But I mean, I could only speak from my family, who are saying, wow, that's so cool, you know.
Right.
But besides that, I don't know. I don't know.
Let's talk about the Mountain Bar a little bit more.
Okay.
Because I'm curious, did you have the opportunity to be a fly on the wall, or do you think that when you were among them, they were sort of, oh, let's be on our best behavior?
I don't think so. No,
yeah.
I definitely feel like I blended in. And then, you know, Piero was very charming. So, you know, he seemed like on good behavior. But Eric Wesley, when I tried to interview him, he seemed kind of defensive and not into it and suspicious. So I don't think they were really putting on a show for me. They seemed kind of slightly suspicious and kind of the whole time about what I was going to do. And so maybe that's also why I was more critical of the way the piece came out, because I thought, oh, I don't know if they're going to be happy. They had made me kind of scared of what they might do to me if they didn't like what I wrote. So I was nervous about that. But I, you know, I did get to be in classes and attend events. And so I saw the things that had drawn me to the school. I got to see them in action. And I felt like I was right. It was really, it seemed like it's just such a cool thing, you know, and it doesn't, I don't know why it happens, you know, I mean, it doesn't, it doesn't seem like there's a whole industry behind it. I mean, no one is making money,
sure.
You know, it's just, so I appreciate how kind of unexpected it is. And
well, I have two questions.
Yeah.
Very connected questions related to the Mountain School. One is, you mentioned that it's free, but the sense that I have is that it's very carefully groomed or recruited.
Uh-huh.
It's not like you just apply and get in. I mean, apparently it's very, very hard to get in.
Oh, really?
That's my sense.
Right. Okay. Well, at the time when I wrote the article, which is, you know, came out in 2011, but I had turned it in, I think, well, I can't remember, but it's probably like 3 years ago or 4 years ago when I was doing the reporting. they said there were 100 applicants around that time, and I think they chose like something like 15 or 16 people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, okay. It seems like a fair
margin.
And it was
democratic, I mean, I guess. I mean,
well, I mean, it's idiosyncratic because they, how are they deciding who they want to be in the program? But,
right.
Yeah.
The other thing that I heard from somebody who I guess met with them in some context or other was that there was a very sort of, within the grooming, there was a very sort of elitist kind of agenda, I think. And I just wonder if you picked up on that in your time with them.
I mean, not particularly. No more than any other art school that you would encounter, for sure. I mean, and
okay.
And it's also, it's lots of people, it seems like a wide range of people who are teaching classes too. It's not, you know, it's not just people who have degrees in their
Well, it's
subject.
Friends of theirs.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, I mean, it's definitely, it's a personal, it's a, you know, that's another thing my editor, I remember, was like pushing me to question, is it a vanity project for them? But, you know, I think in terms of when you start something or do something on your own, it's always going to have that element. I mean, when I was an art editor, you know, often the things that I was choosing to review were things just that I liked.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so it became, you know, although if there was a big exhibition, obviously I have to get someone to cover it, you know, but at the same time, I got to pick and choose, oh, well, here's what I think I'd like to have someone write about. Here's what interests me.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that personal touch, you know, always going to be.
I mean, that's the nature of all business.
What? What's the nature?
That there's people are connected to their friends. And,
sure.
And
yeah.
That's how, I mean, it's the same as art school or jobs or, you know, I mean, if you know someone already, then you know what their talents are, what their skills are, how they could be a teacher or whatever the professional level.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that would be a fair criticism on my part. But what I had heard from somebody from their personal experience, who was not, you know, was already way beyond the age of being in the school, but his experience with that scene was that there was this very elitist vibe. So I just wanted to see if you had, but you haven't. So
I mean, I don't know elitist, but maybe, you know, it didn't seem like the most completely free-loving, like, hippie atmosphere in the world.
What art school is. I mean, I went to an elitist art school, so it's just the nature of art school.
Well, what do we mean, what do you mean when you say elitist?
It's just, it's just a huge question. I mean, it's, for some reason, the art school that I went to accepted me and not someone else. And the art school that I went to is considered to be a really good school and a sort of elitist art school. And it's just known to be that. And I think most of the school, maybe because it's a private school,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure what it is, but all these schools have their reasons for letting certain people in. I don't know what the criteria is.
Right.
Or why they would accept me with my messy VHS tape, you know, at that time.
Right.
And then not accept someone who is a skilled filmmaker, you know,
mm-hmm.
a more skilled filmmaker, but with a different sort of approach.
Right.
You know, I don't know how these things operate, who's accepted and who isn't, but every place has some criteria for accepting people.
Sure.
And whoever isn't let in is going to be like, oh, it's elitist. But whoever's in might not say, oh, it's elite. You know,
right.
It's kind of this, I think.
But I understand what you're saying, but I think I'm talking more about the philosophy and the sort of attitude that is being proliferated. It's not so much who gets in and who doesn't get in, but it's more like the cool kids and sort of the cool club and what have you, that's sort of a paradigm. You know,
yeah, I see what you're saying. Then what you're saying, I'm kind of making a thread now to Piero's thing that he has in the back of Lace, which I forget what it's called, but it's a private art club in the back of Lace. So maybe it's something that somebody felt from Piero or something with this. What is it?
It's something like Alpine.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
what
in
is
the
it
Chatelet.
It's yeah, Chatelet. The chalet.
Yeah, it's you have to have a key. It's for members only. It is a very
that's
it's set
elitist,
up to be
yeah.
a very elitist place. So maybe, you know, that's a part of his thing. I don't know Piero.
Is this, by the way, is this the same Piero that has the Mount Rushmore piece, or is that a different
piece? Oh, with the
piece?
Nose, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
it's the same,
at the,
it's the same guy.
In LA. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just
I
drawing
mean,
connection.
But I think, you know, with the mountain school, at least, or with lots of things in the arts, if you're looking at it from a socioeconomic level, it's like, well, who can really take 3 months? You know, lots of European people seem to come, and which makes sense because I think it's easier in Europe to just be getting money somehow from the state. But it's like, who can take 3 months off? Who can, like, move to LA? Who has the money to do this or that? Like, the terms of the engagement are elitist because it's not open to that many people.
Right.
You know, it's a special, you'd have to hustle to figure
right,
out how to do
it. Right, and you can't get
it.
A grant or a loan.
Yeah,
or
I mean, maybe
like
if
that.
You're from Europe, you
yeah.
actually could. But
oh, yeah, that's
for,
right.
Yeah, for here, I mean, it's not like going to even a private school where you could get financial aid, although they might offer some kind of financial aid. I mean, I think they could work it out somehow, but still, I mean, so in that way. But I think in terms of curriculum or, you know, no more than any like other art school that's in LA, for instance, maybe.
Well, let's change
okay.
course here
okay,
and
sure.
get to maybe more generally you being a writer.
Okay.
Because you have this connection. You've done art writing,
uh-huh.
but you have a more broad sort of cultural spectrum of writing. And I guess the subtext or what I'm getting at is, as a writer, I don't know if I want to use the word journalist, but as, you know, a writer covering the arts, if you will.
Okay.
Do you want to have as broad, you know, a spectrum to pull from as possible? In other words, the problem with being an art writer, particularly an art critic, is that to make a living, you know, your options are incredibly limited.
Right. Yeah. You mean in terms of where you'd be able to, what you'd be writing or where you'd be publishing or what you could do? Yeah. I mean, I guess I kind of am interested in writing longer pieces, more things that involve research. I mean, in, you know, things where I have more time to do them too. I'm really slow. So the kind of grind of, like, let's say, like people who are reviewers, which I really appreciate. And I just think whenever I have a deadline, my energy, everything is just so different. And you're just working. You're just like, you can't rest until it's done. And you're just like kind of funneling into something. And that, even though it's exhausting, it feels really good. So when you finish, you feel great. But I think week in and week out of that seems like quite a real grind. So, yeah, I think I'm interested in writing different kinds of things, kind of different subjects, like letting myself have time to research and think up weird ideas and have things come to me instead of always having to say, oh, God, okay, I have the deadline, got to go, got to see the show. But, you know.
Well, normally how many, say, different pieces, long form or short form, do you have going at once, or is it always different?
I mean, yeah, it's always different. Sometimes it's not that many at all. But, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, well, you had something, you know, a review that you wrote, like that then the editor didn't write back for a month, and then suddenly they wanted this other thing that you wrote from like 2 months ago that you finally get back. Or especially when I was editing a lot too, it was just like every week it seemed like, okay, well, moving things around, focusing things, kind of deciding where you could put your time. And then it usually worked out okay. You know, I'm good because I do procrastinate a lot. So having the deadlines is very helpful in that way. So I'm a little bit of a deadline junkie, but, but I think, you know, there's a way in which something about, I appreciate art, you know, but the things that are maybe more like in the kind of intersections of, it's not quite, you know, like what is someone doing? Like, it's not like necessarily they don't come out and say they're making art, but there's something about passion or focus or obsession or, mm-hmm. you know, some kind of people who are interested in some kind of aesthetic world, or whether it's, you know, in literature or film or writing. I guess I'm drawn to that, you know. So I mean, I wrote something about Kay Chung. Just thinking of everything else I've written, that seems like a similar thing, like where it's this, you know, it's a group of people coming together, making all this infrastructure complete, basically on their own. It's kind of a bit underground, and it becomes something that's like a working organism that's, you know, that is existing kind of based on people's desire to make it exist. And there's no other reason for it. besides that. And it's so that's maybe the most recent thing I can think of.
Well, I was thinking about when I first met you, which was when you were organizing the reading series at Workspace, and you invited me to do a reading and for Valentine's Day, and it was with Christopher Russell and Darren Klein.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And then I think I showed a video, too, and I don't remember if Christopher Russell showed slides or but it was a sort of writers and artists, and you put this together. What was that project?
Oh, yeah. So I did that with a partner, another writer named Nikki Darling.
Could you describe what Workspace is?
Workspace, well, it was, now I think it's just a studio space, but it was this little art space, artist-run space, started by these two artists who then left, and then it was taken over by Daniel Ingroff and Paul Pescador, and then David Gilbert. Came into, and they were all running it. Mm-hmm. They had shows, and it's right in Lincoln Heights. It's kind of at that five corner space where, like, Pasadena and Avenue 26 and all these little streets intersect. So that's why we called the reading 5 points. So yeah, and we would do them about once a month for a while. We were pretty, or maybe once every other month, and did that for about 3.5 years or so. I mean, maybe.
And was it artists and writers who?
I mean, yeah, it was. We would mix it up. So the often it was just writers, but sometimes we'd have people screen film or video, and it was a so that was, I mean, yeah, brought together a lot of different people from Los Angeles. And we would have, our readings were always set around themes. So we had, we had a one night that was where George Picari showed a movie, the photographer George Picari. Michael Ned Holte read a great essay that he wrote on Roger Corman. And then Mary Warnoff read too, which was great. It was that kind of thing of bringing these disparate people together. We had Jonathan Gold read, we had, you know, Harry Dodge show work, you know, just a lot of different people.
It was really, really fun.
It was great. And it was a really small space, so people just, you know, have to stick in there and sit on the floor, and it was kind of gross. And there was, of course, like lots of action from the street, and it was really fun.
And this was from what period?
I think we started this maybe like 2009 to, we did our last reading in 2012 maybe.
So it's like a snapshot of a certain sector of LA culture, you know, existing for a certain amount of time, and now what's taking its place?
With that, well, there's so many art spaces now. I mean, there's not a reading series that I go to all the time. Like, there was this reading series, Veronica Gonzalez, this writer, Gonzalez Pena, this writer who had something called Rocky Point. And those were usually like in Chinatown. They were really great. And they would have kind of bigger name writers, like, you know, lots of people coming from New York. And she'd always have two people together, sometimes three. Those were great. But she moved back to New York. So there hasn't been a reading series. And then even Benjamin Weissman had this great thing at the Hammer. But that seems like that's not happening as much anymore. So anyways, there's not something, you know, that I go to all the time, but, you know, sometimes it just seems like, oh, I go to the library a lot, to the Central Library. But if that's
the reading series.
Allowed. Yeah, but okay. It's obviously a different atmosphere than it was, you know, sitting on the floor in a gallery somewhere. But
do you think, though, that the Night Papers project that you're doing is kind of an extension of that, but in a print form?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's so Night Papers is a newspaper I make with the Night Gallery, and that's basically comes out usually around twice a year, and we've been doing it for 3 years now as well, since 2011, and it's being able to bring together people and pairing them in this way, and kind of, and it's also, I think, the same thing with the reading series, which is an excuse to reach out to people that you like, and it's incredible when they respond and say yes. So the Night Papers,
you're editing
the same thing.
It, but you're not collaborating per se with people.
I edit it with Davida and Mika, who run the gallery, and they, you know, Davida usually does more of the visual side. And she'll bring in writers too, and Mika, same. She's written a couple of pieces for it, actually, and she's really good with getting advertisers. So it's actually, now we're usually able to print the paper through the ads that we get. which is a more recent development. So, yeah, so it's, there's a definite sense of collaboration, and that's kind of the real boiling point when you're putting the paper together, which is like, whoa, it's just, it really takes over your life for a week or so. You know, it's just like getting it and just trying to refine it, and that's, I really enjoy that part. It's really fun because you never know. It's like you have all these elements together. You don't know how it's all going to come together, and suddenly you're working it, and like then you look and it's a paper, and it's, you know, it's so I think this maybe it has a similar aspect to the readings too, where you think, okay, well, wow, I really want, there's this kind of ineffable quality where you're like, I want this person to read, but I just don't know how it's going to go tonight, you know, and then it goes great. And or I mean, a few times I think the readings didn't really come together, and just for some reason it felt like nothing kind of completed. But other times you just pick these people and you think, I have a feeling like this is going to go well, or they'll do great together, and then it would work out, and just felt so relieved and happy.
Is it hard though going from that instant feedback kind of situation to doing the paper where you don't maybe have as much of a sense of the audience?
Yeah, I mean, not so much, because I think it's more just for us, you know, like, seems like people like it okay, and it's usually like, oh, we really want to publish it by this date because this and this thing is happening, or we said we would, or all the ads are going to get old if we don't get it out by, so it's more just like pulling it off, getting it to the printer, not having it, you know, some crazy ink stain all over the place, which just happens. You have to reprint. I think it's, you get the same satisfaction of like, oh, I pulled it off, you know, and it's hard to tell sometimes too. I think I'm like so critical. So in a crowd, you know, I sometimes don't even know if people are enjoying themselves, or I had readings, we'd have readings where I think, oh, this is going horribly. This is really bombing. No one is interested, you know, and then afterwards people say, oh, I really enjoyed that. It was so great.
You know, since we're sort of talking generally about kind of culture production and what have you, I think it's interesting thinking about the reading, you know, which you obviously you've been involved with a lot. I mean, right. Like, talk about, you can be specific if you want to cite examples, but I'm curious. I think it's kind of like, you know, when somebody does a reading of their work, particularly poetry, but certainly with fiction or nonfiction, you're kind of going in and you're kind of already a fan or supporter, or you're kind of there and you don't know anything about this person, and it's like really hit or miss, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say from my experience doing a reading at Workspace and
showing... Of your work?
Of some written... I don't know. People don't know. I do some writing too. So of some piece about Valentine's Day in the 90s, and then I showed a video... And it was, you know, usually I show in, like, film places or, you know, even at an art gallery, like a different kind of setting in an art gallery. But I didn't really know anyone there, and I didn't invite anyone. I just went, and there were a whole bunch of people there. And I thought it was a very good-looking crowd. I was like, this is such an attractive crowd. You know what I mean? Like, different than the sort of... You know, experimental film crowd is a very different crowd. Kate and Nikki, they had this. They tried this very good-looking crowd. It was very nice. Sophisticated, and everybody was great. It was, like, amazing. Yeah. It was really fun for me. Like, going into, like, a new place where I hadn't shown my work before was really exciting, and they created this kind of scene. So it's like this buzz you created from this reading series.
Right.
So it's not just about the readers. It's about the sort of curators, too.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm... this image of, I heard about this kind of pickle that the Japanese people make, where they just like kind of have this base, you know, you just like get this good base and then you just keep on putting whatever you want in the base, and it pickles, and it's like you just keep on adding to it. So I guess I could, like, kind of what you're talking about with the buzz, and this environment.
It was crazy. I found like pictures of my video online and people's Tumblrs and stuff, and it was like, this is great. It keeps going. And then people were polite and put my name in. You know, like, there's this whole, like, scene that was bubbling and happening. And then I got on the mailing list. You know, just...
Yeah.
It was really...
I mean, I think
something.
It had this... you know, I think the context definitely makes a difference with events and energy. And that's what I noticed from readings is there is something... Yeah, like, you can't... That I guess I was always still, like... The ineffable, like, how is it going to turn out, or why is this reading, why was that great, you know,
right.
and their energy, and you are like feeding off the energy of the crowd and whatever that is, and people just, you know, it was like relaxed, and it was mostly friends, and sometimes I guess it would be other people, so it's just a different kind of atmosphere than lots of places where you go and it's like a big space and people are like back from the crowd and they don't seem, you know, you, it wasn't the most comfortable place to be either because it was so small and hot and sweaty. So I think you'd really want to have to go there to go there. So maybe that was a part of it too. But I also think that, yeah, the people that we chose had a nice energy. But when I go to readings, I really like readings. So I know lots of people don't. Actually, I know like tons of people that really hate readings, but I enjoy them. Because I like to just sit back and listen to people. So I don't know. I guess it can go bad, but sometimes people just aren't good readers, you know, they're really shy. I mean, I get really nervous myself, but
right.
So I think that's, you know, someone can read something that's not that great too. Another thing, if they're doing it well, if they perform it well, you know, it's like they get the crowd laughing, then it's like they get confident, then they really go for it and it's great, but
yeah, I think I'll weigh in on probably what a lot of people who maybe are more challenged by readings deal with, which is I listen to things a lot, podcasts and what have you, so I'm not non-auditory, but when you listen to something passively, it's incredibly different than, like, this conversation we're having in person, you know, when we listen, or people listen to it, it's a completely different experience. So when I go and see somebody give a reading of any kind, whether it's poetry, fiction, an art reading, or whatever, I'm so visual that I get so distracted by, you know, what's going on in the crowd, what the person's wearing, you know, what their affectations are, you know what I mean? So it's so easy. If I'm not, like, somehow connecting with the material right away, you know, my head is kind of gone and elsewhere.
Yeah, and you're probably not alone in that. But I think it's the, you know, it's like when you watch anything difficult, you know, if you watch a long, difficult movie, like kind of, it's right. okay to, you're not supposed to be like bound and wrapped the entire time. I mean, that's not realistic. It's like, if you go away and come back and go away and come back,
right.
that can be a part of it too.
Right.
See, I like connecting that, like the language to what someone in the room might be wearing or how they're reacting. It all, for me, becomes a part of the whole experience.
Right.
And also seeing the author. If I don't know the author, what actually seeing what they look like and then learning about their life or whatever the sort of small talk is in between. But it does depend on the material, doesn't it?
It does, How many readings have you done yourself?
Oh, I don't know. Probably
a good
quite
amount.
A bit, yeah.
Yeah.
A good amount. But
and do you enjoy that experience?
Yeah, I mean, when it's over.
It's stressed because it's stressful for you.
I just get so nervous. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really have little shaky hands.
And do you find that as you get going for a bit, you start to relax or not?
Sometimes,
really?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
But I've had times before where I've been so nervous, I really thought like I'm not going to be able to do this. My chest was pounding so hard, my heart. But but then when it's over, you feel really good. But I also come from a theater background, so I wouldn't think I would be as nervous. But I think it's just, you know, just you alone in front of all these people. And I've definitely had readings where I bombed real bad, real bad.
But it's so funny you use that word because as you were describing, you know, what you're doing, there is a parallel with like doing comedy. You know, I mean, obviously you don't have to hit the laughs, but you are completely on your own. It's completely your own material. And I was just thinking before that, you know, I was trying to sort of draw a comparison of artists and writers, you know, that they do very private arts, but when they perform, whether it's talking about their work if they're artists or reading their work if they're writers, you know, that's really a whole different experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's different, but I mean, some people are performers, so they're
right.
they're into,
and there's a bias towards performance
right now,
right? No, I mean, if you're a great performer, that's going to raise up your profile, isn't it?
Oh, as a reader, as a writer? I guess, yeah, it depends.
It doesn't hurt.
Well, if you talk about your work really well, or
no, I'm like if you're just comparing, you know, two writers who have the same quality. One of them is a great performer, a great reader, and the other one is really nervous and shaky and so on. You know.
Yeah, but I think, you know, some people, their work might lend itself to being read and to be performed, and they have right. a great persona that, you know, doesn't mean they're any better as a writer when someone just is holding the book alone, or it's more dynamic or interesting.
Right.
You know, some things aren't. So I can help you. I think it can also hurt you. Not hurt you, but it might limit what you're willing to do, because if you always have to have the crowd, if you always have to be charming and seducing the crowd in that way,
right.
you know, you might not go as deep as you could otherwise.
Yeah. Then you'd be like a show person or something.
Yeah.
Or as a sort of like a nervous, neurotic reader or something, I might be attracted
yeah,
to
exactly.
that, to say, oh, well, that's what's behind that person, is this right. like mad genius but shy, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that I find from reading or performing or whatever I'm doing that I feel nervous, but I wonder if the nervousness is just something I'm sort of addicted to?
Yeah.
Because, like, I've done a lot of that, but I still get a little nervous. I mean, not as nervous as the first time I had to give a public performance about my work. I, like, did it by, like, getting naked. I was so nervous.
Oh,
I was just,
God.
Like, I didn't sleep all night, and then I just got naked during it. It was sort of related to the piece, but I was like, I am so nervous, I'm just going to make it worse. So, but you know what I mean?
How did that go?
It was great. Yeah, it was good.
Did you find that you relaxed when you got naked? Because there was nowhere else to go?
It was about, like, female empowerment or something.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, once you do that, like, how could you be nervous? Because you're naked, so you're just nervous anyway. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that because I did a performance the other day, I felt myself getting nervous. But there's really, if you think about it, like, there's no reason to be nervous. And I thought, well, I think it's because I kind of get off on that. It was just a
right.
thought, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit for me anyway. Just that.
Yeah.
I'm used to it. I like that feeling of being a little bit nervous. It's like being a little bit on edge.
I think it's good. Yeah, yeah. Usually if you're too relaxed, it can get a little sloppy. But
yeah.
Sometimes, yeah.
So, Kate, is there another workspace-like scene in your future, do you think?
I hope so.
It kind of will happen organically. You're not going to, like, try to
sum
it up somehow.
My partner and I have this new studio space together. So I'm hoping to use my half of the space to show movies and to have kind of like an underground cinema space and do readings and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. So we'll see.
Okay.
But I think, you know, it's LA's. I have noticed since that workspace, you know, there's so many little places that pop up and so many scenes, you know, constantly turning over that, I don't know. There's definitely been, you know, since workspace closed, I feel like there's probably been like 10 other workspaces, but it would be fun for me to be a part of something like that again, you know, so.
As somebody who is the you know, editor at LA Review of Books and covers arts, to what extent do you feel an obligation to sort of cover or be aware of all of those separate scenes that are going on?
That's why maybe I wouldn't even call myself an art writer, because that would mean I'd have to go to all these things.
Obligation.
Yeah, exactly. But I usually just like kind of drawn to them, or it happens, you know, someone I end up there, so I
right.
but I don't, yeah, it's if I was more made a more concerted effort to go, you know, I because that's not what I do, quote unquote, I get kind of lazy, because I really like doing most is reading, so I'd rather just be at home, I guess, reading. But besides that, I feel like I end up going to lots of these places, or
yeah,
you know, or there are other people who do the work, like going out there making lists of all the alternative spaces in LA right now, and I can check it out like that.
What are some of your observations about the Los Angeles literary scene, or the literary scene, you know, in general and across the country, for that matter?
Oh, well,
perhaps in the context of the art world that we are more familiar with.
Okay. Well, I think it's interesting how lots of people, there are lots of writers who seem to be embraced more by the art world by then this kind of conventional literary, you know, I don't know, big publishing house scene. And usually those writers, I think, can feel, I think often that comes with a sense of frustration. Like, oh, why can't I have a larger audience? Why don't I have a better publishing deal? But it's often that those are the writers that I think other writers or lots of other people are actually most interested in. You know, that usually people who don't just like have perfect crossover and who aren't, you know, who maybe are more extreme in what they write about or the way they write or more experimental, are really more interesting in general. So that's what I've noticed that more and more, that there seems to be a kind of writing that the art world embraces, that normal literary scenes, you know, really the stuff that's like really conventional and boring, that doesn't kind of carry over as much. And then it slowly starts to happen. And this writer who you maybe have known about for years and years and years, it's like, oh, then like, you know, more mainstream people are like, just, you know, just kind of discovering them now. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like Chris Krause is someone like that, where you think, oh, well, it's just like a given to me. Like, I think Chris Krause is an amazing writer. She's, you know, she's, and to me, she's been like kind of famous for a long time, or at least to me. But it seemed like, oh, recently, like all these, I mean, and that's another thing that's kind of perennial, someone whose books can be rediscovered because they're still as relevant and important now as they were 15 years ago, you know? So I think that, but I noticed like, oh, all these young girls, or like Lena Dunham discovered Chris Krause's I Love Dick, and or she put it on Instagram or something, which is great. I think it's awesome. But, you know, I
is
wonder.
Is she getting a book deal, though?
Well, I mean, she has her own publishing company. I'm just saying, but someone like to me, like Chris is a good example, who you think, oh, she should be like, to me, she's like a really famous writer, but maybe in her eyes, she's not, you know, she's more like has been more embraced by the art world, less by the conventional publishing world, and she's too extreme for the conventional publishing world. I mean, I don't think she's definitely been embraced by the conventional publishing world as well, but probably not as much as she deserves, or, and however you want to interpret that, what deserves mean. I mean, she's done a great thing. She has this awesome press,
mm-hmm.
you know, but just things where you think, well, why is this one person so celebrated? Their work is super boring to me. And this other person is like more on the edges, but I feel like they're the way more, and the references could be the exact same. It's not like they're reading like similar things there, but maybe the person who's more on the side actually has like the longer, more involved list of associations and references and knows way more about all these kind of more academic or interesting things. I don't know. So that's something I've noticed, like that there is some kind of divide. And sometimes I think the art world is actually like embracing writing that I care about a lot more than some guy writing about his girlfriend in Brooklyn.
What does it look like when the art world embraces a certain writer or writing?
Well, I think it means that those people often write for art magazines. They're asked to participate in things. You mm-hmm. know, they're just more of a figure within that world.
Right. Well, I mean, also they can, there could be published by a smaller press, right? So they don't have to sell a certain number of books. Right. If they're like, would a more mainstream writer go with a different kind of publisher where they might have to sell more books? Because it seems like there's a lot of art publishers now, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there any books, art related or you know, smaller publisher or larger publisher that you would like to, you know, plug right now?
Oh.
You know, for the summer of 2014?
Sure. Well, I think people should read Sarah Lara Grayer's book on Lee Lozano. Just came out in the spring from After All.
Okay. That's it?
Yeah. Well, and just, sure. Okay. And read, you know, buy everything from Semiotext and...
okay. What about long-form topics that you have either in the hopper or that you're, you know, sort of hoping to take on?
Oh, yeah. Well, I do have a piece that I really want to start working on, but I don't really want to
keep it under wraps.
I like to keep it a little secret before I do. But that is something that would, you know, take some research, and I'd have to kind of figure out how to tell. It's a complicated story. I'd have to figure out how to tell it. And
is that a book or
no? It's just like a long form mm-hmm. article I'd like to work on. But I recently read this Janet Malcolm book that was recommended to me by a lot of people, called The Journalist and the Murderer,
mm-hmm.
which I would actually, although it's out, you know, it's like it's a classic, and
sure.
I recommend it. But it's a lot about this relationship between a subject and a writer, And it's kind of, it has to do with this whole case about this guy that was said to have killed his wife and children. And actually, Errol Morris made a documentary on this recently, or this other book came out, this guy Jeffrey McDonald. But so he was kind of like butchered at the hands of this journalist who said he was going to write a book about him, or who did write this book, but it, you know, he pretended the whole time that he was on his side. And then when the book came out, he basically, the writer had said, this guy is a murderer, he's psycho, you know, he's a psychopath, all this stuff, and it took the guy completely by surprise.
Right.
And then the guy sued this writer, and he won. Jeffrey McDonald sued the writer. And so anyways, and then Janet Malcolm comes in, and she is writing a book about the writer who got sued. So it's like she's kind of this like snake tail eating itself, like all this, you know, everyone using, not using each other, but that, you know, having that relationship with someone. And I guess that was inspiring to me, because it's hard for me to want to, I just don't want to offend people or be mean to them, or I would never think, oh, I'm going to, like, they told me this is off the record, but I'm just going to put it in my piece anyways. You know, that's really hard for me. But I guess reading that book made me feel like, well, that's the pact that you make when you let someone write a piece about you. So I should be a little bit more like that. More cutthroat. I don't know.
Well, you have a few minutes if you want to be cutthroat right now.
Oh, no, no. Not right now.
It's interesting because, Michael, you're the same way. I mean, you're not like, you're very generous to your guests. I mean, it seems you're both very ethical in that way. I mean, I think it's just about having ethics.
Right. But it's, yeah. But that, I think having ethics in that way, it can hold you back.
Well, you can't be a critic then, right? You can't really be a hardcore critic if you don't want to. That's not just, I mean, certainly you can be an ethical critic, but I'm just saying that if you don't, it depends on maybe what, right. Would it be like your style of writing? Is that what you call it? Like some people just have a different way that they write. That's how I would look at it.
Right.
I mean, do you trash shows ever?
I would never like come out and trash it.
Some writers trash shows, right?
But I might like have to, I would maybe take some kind of like moralistic standpoint, like, oh, this person, it's their first show, they don't deserve to get a bad review, that's really low. I wouldn't do that. But if it was someone who I think, oh, like morally, I think that they're exploiting like the art market and they're making horrible work and like they're just, and they're like a guy and they're getting rich, and I would probably feel more free to just say, or like, you know, I've trashed like the most, like Jeffrey Deitch, like the street art show. That's probably like the show I felt no compunction about.
A lot of people trash.
Trashing, yeah, because it's easy to trash that. And I just, it had such a sense of its own glory, you know, and Jeffrey Deitch putting his importance in the history of street art, and what is even street art? I was just like disgusted. And that was easy. I didn't feel any shame. But I think if you're like in a scene of people too, like let's say I'm like mostly writing about people that I'm going to like pass or know, you know, it's like I don't feel free to just say anything about
them.
To
be a career killer.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just laughing about that. You know, for a young artist, a first review could be really, really is really important.
It is. Yeah. But I mean, I think if you got a really, I wonder how bad, I guess it depends what was bad. Because I think lots of people, it's interesting to me that there are lots of artists I don't think have critical respect that seem like financially they're doing great, so.
And vice versa, yeah.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Are there any, going back a few minutes ago, are there any subjects, when you're talking about, you know, your relationship to subjects, or, you know, in this book, in the case of the book, are there any that you've had kind of any lingering relationships with over, you know, once a piece is done, mm-hmm. or is it like once the piece is over, you kind of go your separate ways pretty much?
Well, I have met people writing about them that, yes, then we had relationships after.
What kind of relationship? Romantic, it looks like, based on her expression, right?
Yeah, I have that. That is how I met someone that I dated. So,
okay,
but, a good review.
But, no, I tore into shreds. No, I'm just kidding. But so that's an ongoing relationship in a way. I mean, we're not together anymore, obviously. Right. But so, yeah, I mean,
that's interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Can you elaborate a little bit? Do you mind?
Sure. Oh, I mean, how do you want me to elaborate?
Well, I mean, so did you write a review about somebody's show?
It wasn't a review. It was more like I was here. And I mean, it's like so classic. That's interesting because it's another, it's kind of, Janet Malcolm talks about this in the book too. I mean, when you're in the process, who wouldn't want some person coming in and saying, wow, what you're doing is so interesting. Oh, I'm fast. I'm going to take notes. I'm like paying so much attention to you,
yeah.
You know, and then you're in that position and it's just, I think there is something always slightly romantic with a subject and a, even if it's, you know, even if for that moment you have to finesse them, you mm-hmm. want, you want to get something good from them, whatever it is. I mean, just interesting. You need,
right.
you need some kind of emotional connection. So it does, the kind of intensity of just being with someone, just interviewing them, talking to them, like it does breed, even if it's a platonic kind of romance, but still a different intensity than you'd have with almost anyone just when, who you just met for the first time. So yeah, I think sometimes there, and I think it can almost get confusing sometimes too. Not like I, that hasn't really been a problem for me, but just you focus, you know, it's like, I don't know, you just focus so much on someone or something. You have a false sense of intimacy sometimes. You feel like, I've had that with interview subjects where I think afterwards, I think, oh my God, like, I want to be, we're going to be friends. This
right,
is
right,
great.
Right.
And then you, it's,
so it goes
and
both,
it's over.
Yeah.
And it's over.
No, so yeah. What you pointed out though, is it goes both ways. I mean, because what you were sort of describing with your, you know, the person you dated is that they probably were charmed, you know, by the attention.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so they, you know, they became more focused on you had it, you met in different circumstances. But yet at the same time, the writer also can be charmed by their subject.
Yes.
And sort of be swept off their feet.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then, you know, find out that, in fact, the subject has moved on.
Yes. Yes. I've had that with, I mean, almost everyone I've interviewed has been, if it's a long form interview, it's been someone I really respected,
right.
And who I totally looked up to. So just to get to even talk to them for that long was, you know, incredibly exciting. And
yeah.
Yeah. So, but you can't get fooled. Can't get fooled. You have to keep your senses about you. So
right,
something
right,
I've learned
right.
a little bit more these days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Oh,
I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Kate.
Oh, thank
great.
You.
Thank you,
yeah,
Margie.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Michael.
And we're out.
Oh, and we're out.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Feel free to let us know what you think via the website. The email is theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. All the other social media outlets via the website. And tell your friends about the show if they don't already know about it. Thank you very much for being here once again, and I look forward to talking to you soon.